going to be tough on a lot of folks, and we're going to see a lot of changes in Southeast Alaska.
Southeast halibut quotas get hit with big cuts. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, working to get rid of a health care law provision that was unpopular with small business.
I think we kept stirring the pot, but it started from small business people talking about how to reduce the paperwork on their backs.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD and consider sharing a portion with your favorite charity through Pick, Click, Give. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Longliners in Southeast and the Gulf of Alaska will see big cuts to their quotas this year under catch numbers approved by the International Pacific Halibut Commission this morning. Along with the commercial reductions, the commission is also recommending a limit on the size of halibut that charter boat clients can keep in Southeast. The annual meeting in Victoria, British Columbia was online. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein listened in and has this report.
The three Canadian and three U.S. members of the Halibut Commission unanimously approved the staff's area-by-area recommendations for a total coastwide catch of about 41 million pounds this year. That's down about 19% from last year. Some areas will see increases, but most will be cut. Southeast Alaska Area 2C is the hardest hit with a 2.33 million pound quota. That's down 47% from last year, and the reduction comes on the heels of another 60% worth of cuts over the previous 5 years. Commissioner Philip Lestenkoff of Alaska said it was a very tough decision for the U.S. members.
Because we know the economic hardships that a lower catch limit in Area 2C will cause. But on the other hand, we feel that Area 2C has been an area of concern, and taking less fish out this year in 2011 hopefully will make a big impact on turning Area 2C around for the future.
Southeast fishing industry representatives say the impacts will be substantial for skippers, deckhands, and their communities. Julianne Curry is a Southeast halibut quota shareholder and serves as director of the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association.
The numbers have gotten low enough to where the amount of people who are going to be pushed out of the business is going to be noticeable this year. I think people were struggling to make their quota share payments before this action happened, but it's really going to be compounded this year because people have lost well over half their quota. I think this puts us around the 70% range. So it's going to be tough on a lot of folks, and we're going to see a lot of changes in Southeast Alaska.
Scientists say there are more individual halibut out there. The problem is that they're growing way too slowly. So slowly, in fact, that according to IPHC staff, the exploitable biomass, the fish that are big enough to harvest, has declined by 50% coastwide over the past decade. The commission's action for Area 2C was not limited to the commercial fleet this year. It also unanimously recommended a new measure to further restrict catches by the sport charter fleet in Southeast Alaska. It imposes a 37-inch maximum size limit for halibut kept on board the region's charter boats. U.S. Commissioner Ralph Hoard emphasized that the commercial sector has taken major cuts over the past several years, while the charter fleet has exceeded its guideline harvest level, which is set by the U.S. North Pacific Fishery Management Council.
We have received reports from the commission staff and our advisors that without additional management measures, charter harvest in 2011 will yet again exceed the 2C GHL.
The new size limit for halibut on charter boats is in addition to a daily one-fish limit that the North Pacific Council imposed on Southeast charter clients in 2009. That's down from the normal two-fish limit for sport fishing. The North Pacific Council has put a new limited entry system in place as well that's expected to reduce the Southeast charter fleet substantially. However, an accompanying system of regulations to better control the charter harvest is not coming online at least until 2012. Charter operators contacted for this report were not not immediately available for interview. In a minority statement earlier at this week's meeting, charter representatives to the IPHC Conference Board opposed more restrictions by the commission this year, saying that would cause serious financial hardship to individual operators and hurt local economies. All of the commission's recommendations require approval by the U.S. Commerce Secretary and Canada's Minister of Fisheries and Oceans. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Senator Mark Begich says the U.S. Senate now has the votes to repeal an unpopular provision in the national health care law that small businesses complained about. The Health Care Act passed last year requires businesses to file IRS 1099 forms for every vendor they paid more than $600 to. The effort to strip that out of the law hit 60 co-sponsors this week. President Obama called for getting rid of the 1099 provision during his State of the Union speech. He defended the overall health care law, but said he's open to improvements.
We can start right now by correcting a flaw in the legislation that has placed an unnecessary bookkeeping burden on small businesses.
Begich says the president's support is helping gain momentum in Congress. He says things are finally working out, but it's after months of trying to convince Democratic leadership and the White House.
People have come full circle. I mean, having the president note it and actually got an enormous round of applause when almost a year ago they were telling me, forget about it, it's not an issue. I think we kept stirring the pot, but it started from small business people talking about how to reduce the paperwork on their backs.
Begich says he's still supportive of the overall health care law and says this is not a sign that it's flawed. He says implementing a bill is the hardest part of lawmaking.
At the end of the day, you expect you're going to have tweaks and modifications to legislation. Of course, no one takes claim that they put this in there, which I found very interesting when I started asking around. Everyone says, I don't know how that got in there. Well, someone put it in, I sure the heck didn't. And so, then in that case, when there's no ownership and it also is burdensome on small business, it needs to go.
The provision is scheduled to kick in next year unless Congress acts. Among the 60 senators who have signed on are 14 other Democrats and 45 Republicans, including Senator Lisa Murkowski. Begich says the Senate could vote on it as soon as next week. Congressman Don Young is a co-sponsor of the House version of the 1099 fix. Anchorage's economy fared better than expected last year, while 2011 should show even more job growth. KSKA's Len Anderson reports on the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation's annual forecast.
Approximately 1,400 members of the city's business community packed the sold-out AEDC luncheon at the Denina Convention and Civic Center for the corporation's annual description of Anchorage's economic health.
The bottom line is that, yes, Anchorage took a step back in 2009, regained some of that lost ground in 2010, and based on our forecast, Anchorage will continue to grow in 2011.
Bill Popp, Anchorage Economic Development Corporation President and CEO, delivered the rapid-fire presentation that profiled the city's major business sectors. Popp began by admitting the errors of last year's forecast. The contracted researchers and corporation staff had predicted a loss of jobs in 2010. A preliminary tally shows Anchorage actually gained 500 jobs. In 2011, the corporation predicts 1,100 new jobs. If so, Anchorage would surpass 2008's all-time high with an employment roll of well over 152,000. The increase will not come from Alaska's major economic engine, the oil and gas industry.
Oil and gas employment in Anchorage fell by 100 jobs in 2010 and is forecast to remain flat in 2011.
While not growing, at least for the industry's Anchorage-based workers, employment levels have remained stable at about 2,600. And Anchorage's 2010 job loss of 100 compares to a statewide drop the same year of 800 jobs.
In the short term, the job numbers could get a boost if Shell is able to proceed with plans to begin Beaufort Sea exploration drilling in 2011, and if a jackup rig is actually mobilized to Cook Inlet.
On the other hand, Pop says unsolved taxation questions, along with permitting and environmental issues, could impact the industry's long-range status. The greatest employment increase will once again arise from the city's medical sector.
Healthcare jobs increased by 500 in 2010 and are forecasted to grow by 300 more in 2011.
Since 2002, Anchorage has added 4,600 healthcare jobs. That represents about 45% of the city's net employment growth over the same period. Anchorage's leisure and hospitality industry survived 2010 better than expected, although it still lost 100 jobs.
The driving forces behind the better-than-expected performance were higher per-visitor spending levels by cruise ship passengers, the filming in Anchorage of the Hollywood movie Everybody Loves Whales, and the return from deployment of about 3,000 military personnel.
The troop impact reflects the restaurant and bar portion of this category. Pop says many of this sector's 10,000 jobs depend upon resident consumption. AEDC predicts 200 new jobs in 2011. As for other areas in 2011, construction, for the first time since 2006, will gain jobs, about 100. Retail trade, also up 100. Transportation, up 300 jobs. Financial activities, up 100, but government down by 200. Along with its 2011 forecast, the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation also released its Anchorage Business Confidence Index. The index, now in its third year, showed that for the first time, all six elements were in the positive range. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how to rev up excitement before a sled dog race.
I'd have to say that We Will Rock You is one of the best songs to get your dog team going.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The prosecution continued hearing testimony from witnesses in the state's ongoing trial against Rochelle Waterman in Anchorage today. In taped testimony recorded at Waterman's first trial in 2006, Dr. Frank Falico, a forensic pathologist, describes in gritty detail what autopsy results showed after Lori Waterman's body was discovered.
When the whole body was not there, what remained were 33 pounds of what we call cremains, or very badly burned charred remains.
Dental records proved the identity of the body. Falico testified Lori Waterman died of blunt force injury, and the circumstances surrounding the death clearly indicated homicide. The Craig housewife and mother was abducted and murdered in November of 2004. James C., who was police chief in Craig at the time of the murder, described how he went to the Waterman home to alert Lori Waterman's husband, Doc Waterman, of the possibility that the body found in the burned van may be his wife. At the home, C. encountered two things.
Mr. Waterman told me that he needed to show me something upstairs. He said, I've got something you need to see. And he had one of those small facial mirrors sitting in the bathroom on the counter. I looked at it and I immediately knew that we had major problems. Or I felt we had major problems because I could see the tip from a finger of a rubber glove. And he picked up a couple of strands of what appeared to me to be polypropylene rope.
C. also told jurors today that he saw Jason Arendt lingering near the Waterman home at that time. Arendt seemed interested and asked, what's going on? C. told him to leave the crime scene immediately and sealed the house. Rochelle Waterman was seeing Jason Arendt at the time of the murder, to the displeasure of her mother. Investigators identified Arendt as a suspect almost immediately. In today's court session, jurors heard a recording of investigators interviewing Rochelle Waterman the day after the body was found. Robert Kloss, who was an Alaska State Trooper present during that interview, told jurors that Rochelle Waterman seemed calm and not visibly upset at the time her statements were taken. Rochelle Waterman is being tried for the second time for conspiracy and murder in the death of her mother. Her first trial ended with a hung jury. Arendt and a second man, Brian Riddell, were convicted and are serving prison terms for the murder. Alaska senators voted yesterday to ban the practice of putting anonymous holds or blocks on legislation and appointments. The secret holds tradition got the scorn of Senator Mark Begich last year when the president's appointee to be U.S. Marshal for Alaska got stuck in limbo because Republicans blocked it. Rob Hune was eventually confirmed by the Senate, but Begich was frustrated by the lag time. Oftentimes, secret holds of appointees had nothing to do with the person or job, but were politically motivated to make a point. President Obama called for the practice to end in last year's State of the Union address. Both Senator Begich and Lisa Murkowski voted with 90 other senators to end the secret holds. Four senators voted to keep the practice, all Republicans, and most of them members of the brand new Senate Tea Party caucus. Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina and freshman Mike Lee of Utah and Rand Paul of Kentucky. Senator John Ensing of Nevada also voted to keep secret holds. The new rules say the names of a senator blocking legislation will be published in the congressional record 2 days after a hold is placed. Yesterday, Senate leadership on both the Democratic and Republican sides said they reached an agreement to limit the number of presidential appointees that will need confirmation by the full Senate. That's in hopes of cutting down the number of holds and filibusters and lightening the Senate's workload. Democratic and Republican leadership also agreed to compromise when bills come up for a vote. Democrats say they will allow more Republican amendments, and Republicans said they will filibuster less. That agreement, however, was non-binding or guaranteed to stay in place. A Kodiak fisherman who threatened a federal fisheries observer has avoided jail time after a judge sentenced him to community service and ordered anger management therapy. 45-year-old Jeffrey Eugene Scott had been the skipper of the vessel Dusk, owned by Kodiak businessman Al Birch. Birch said the incident began after Scott had dumped a load of pollock in Kodiak Harbor.
He had illegally dumped or caught in load of pollock, which is a federal offense, and it built up from there, and he had dumped it in view of the observer.
Court documents say Scott then chased the fisheries observer to the parking lot of Pacific Seafoods, where he threatened her as she was trying to leave. That happened on October 7, 2009. Birch said he had fired Scott shortly before the parking lot incident. NOAA enforcement agents interviewed Scott later that day. He reportedly told them he could do whatever he wanted to the female observer if he saw her in town. He was criminally charged in federal court and pleaded guilty this month to two misdemeanor counts for threatening a fisheries observer. The judge sentenced Scott to 3 years probation and ordered him to serve 100 hours of community service as well as therapy. His former employer says the sentence seems appropriate.
Yeah, he needs anger management, not jail time.
The judge also ordered that Scott's future interactions with fisheries observers be limited.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu. No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
The Fairbanks Assembly has approved an ordinance that eliminates fine particulate emission standards and fines for violating them. The changes come in response to a proposition passed by voters last fall that stops the borough from banning, prohibiting, or fining people for the use of home heating devices. Borough Attorney Renee Broker said the proposition leaves the Assembly no wiggle room to go after people who smoke out their neighbors.
If you look at the definition of misuse, it's clear that misuse is a type or manner of use.
The Assembly heard hours of testimony last night from people who claim public health should supersede an unregulated right to heat. Fairbanks resident Douglas Yates advocated for retaining key provisions of the old smoke ordinance, equating the responsibility to regulate air quality to basic traffic law enforcement.
The smoke trespass provision, the 50% opacity feature, and the prohibition on wet wood must remain in the ordinance. To do less so is to suggest that some people will be allowed to run red lights, ignoring minimal expectations of health and safety and welfare.
Assembly members were sympathetic to people who testified about health problems precipitated by smoke, but ultimately passed the weakened ordinance 7-1. The new law retains a popular old stove and boiler repair, replacement, and removal program and adds clean burning pellet appliances as a go-to option. It also keeps in place educational outreach on clean burning and a ban on burning high smoky fuels like railroad ties, plywood, and wet cordwood. Assembly members agreed the panel is far from done grappling with fine particulate pollution. The Environmental Protection Agency requires the borough and state to develop a plan for bringing Fairbanks air quality into compliance with federal standards by December of 2012. Diane Benson has been hired to promote a gas line from the North Slope to Fairbanks. The Democrat who ran unsuccessfully for lieutenant governor last fall is the new public relations director for the Fairbanks Pipeline Company, which has proposed the project. Benson says the job is in line with her desire to see state residents benefit from Alaskan resources.
That hasn't changed just because an election is over. I'm very excited about a natural gas pipeline project that actually benefits Alaskans, and I think they have the best, most detailed proposal, and so I'm really excited to be part of the team.
Benson and gubernatorial candidate Ethan Berkowitz advocated for Alaskan investment in a gas line during their bid for office. She says the Fairbanks Pipeline Company would allow Alaskans to buy shares in their gas line project.
It doesn't require costly subsidies from the state, which I think is very important to point out. And it's not tied to exportation. And, you know, I think we've been, as a state, we've bought into too much rhetoric from other interests, maybe even from the federal level, and we can counter that.
The company's proposed 12-inch diameter pipeline is designed to provide gas to fuel the Fairbanks area's large consumers like Golden Valley Electric, Eielson Air Force Base, and Alyeska. Benson says there's a bill in the legislature that would allow state participation in the Fairbanks gas line project. The Kenai Peninsula's Tustamina 200 sled dog race and other races this Saturday will bring together a full spectrum of mushers. KDLL's Ben Stanton takes a look at some of what motivates the racers.
Let's start with the one of the three with the most experience on the sled, who likes the Kenai Peninsula as a setting for a race.
You've always had such a pretty trail there. I'm really looking forward to it.
Dee Dee John Rowe of Willow has been mushing since 1979, over 3 decades, and so far she has some impressive numbers at the Iditarod, including the fastest time of any woman, 13 top 10 finishes, and in 1998 had a second place finish that was the 5th fastest time at that point. John Rowe says she likes the challenge of developing each of her dog's abilities through her interaction with them.
You know, it's funny because I don't really want to have somebody else's dog team. That I don't find myself over the years envying somebody else's dog team. And I think that's because it's the real attraction to me is developing my dogs to be the very best they can be.
In that relationship, John Rowe says in many ways the dogs become her best friends. Last year, when John Rowe finished in the number 22 spot in the Iditarod, another musher from Kisilov finished 36th, Colleen Roberta. She says the T200 is a professional and well-organized race, but she says like any race, she gets nervous beforehand. It's a different story, though, once the race starts.
A sense of calm can come over you, and you're just focused on focused on the dogs. You know, I tend to get a pretty sour stomach in the morning. So, and I just got to work through that. And then, you know, you really focused on getting your dogs bootied, being prepped and ready. I try and be real interactive with spectators in the crowd. They have a lot of questions about the lifestyle, about the dogs, about individual dogs.
Roberta says although she has raced and finished the longer Iditarod, a race like the 200 miles at Tustamina ends up offering a special challenge.
So I actually get more nervous for these shorter races. You know, I'm going into it with the mindset that I know I have the team to win, I know I can win, I know I want to win, and I've worked hard for it, and my dogs have worked hard for it. So I think I actually put more pressure on myself for the mid-distance races.
The day on Saturday also includes a shorter race for the youngest mushers. The Junior T is a 50-mile race. This 14-year-old musher says he expects a fun day.
I'm very excited. I'm looking forward to it. Just, you know, get to go run with the dogs, get to go meet the other mushers. It's a really fun event. I like this race a lot.
Conway Seavey of Sterling comes from a family of dog mushers. We had heard that when he was a baby, a family friend had given him a gift of a personalized blanket that read, Conway Seavey, Iditarod 2015.
Now that is the year I'll turn 18 then, and I can do the Iditarod. Yeah, so that blanket is a very true story. It's still on my bed right now, actually.
The Seavey family of mushers includes three of Conway's brothers who have impressive mushing records, and his father, Mitch Seavey, who took first place in the 2004 Iditarod. Conway Seavey's other interests include music. He plays guitar, piano, and he is a singer. So what song does this teenager think gets the dogs ready for a race? Well, one from the 1970s rock band Queen, of course.
I'd have to say that We Will Rock You is one of the best songs to get your dog team going. I mean, nothing really comes close to We Will Rock You by Queen.
Seavey will join the other Junior T racers for a 9 a.m. start time Saturday. Then the T200 starts at 11, followed by the T100. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Len Anderson and Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ben Stanton in Kenai. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
When you file online for your PFD, you can donate to any of 40 Alaska organizations that provide healthcare services for those who might otherwise go without. Get more with your PFD when you pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation and Providence Health Services Alaska. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.